all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, April 26, 2009. Today we have a terrific show for you. We've got someone we've been hoping to have as a guest for quite some time. We've got him scheduled today. Kevin Phillips will be joining us to discuss his new book, Bad Money, one of the really important books of the last several years to explain the situation we've gotten into with our economy today and the problems this suggests for us and holds for us as a nation going future, not just in the months, but in the years. So we have a great show for you today. Kevin Phillips will be joining us live on the phones. But before we go to Kevin Phillips, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
2 weeks ago, Media Minutes reported that Time Warner Cable planned to introduce a new tiered broadband pricing scheme that would have forced consumers to pay up to $150 a month for full access to the internet. Four markets were targeted for the experiment, two in Texas, one in New York, and one in North Carolina. On April 16th, the cable giant backed down. Free Press campaign director Timothy Carr says the plan was met with an intense negative reaction from the grassroots that reverberated through the halls of Congress.
It sparked local outrage. It really started at the consumer level. You had a group like StopTheCap.com, which was formed by a few Time Warner Cable users based in Rochester who put up a website, started posting videos and blogs there about the growing consumer protest. And this soon caught the attention of other groups like ours, Free Press. We went out and started to ask our 500,000 activists to raise their voice in protest and call on Congress to investigate this Time Warner scheme. And then members of Congress, beginning with Eric Massa, who represents a lot of the people in Rochester, New York, wrote a letter demanding a full explanation and has proposed legislation which would stop this sort of metering. And it was really a multi-pronged collaboration that created this snowball effect that landed firmly on the executives at Time Warner Cable. They ultimately capitulated when Senator Schumer of New York flew up to Rochester to have a meeting with some of the activists and some of the Time Warner Cable execs. And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back in this case. And we saw a very powerful corporation that had sought to become a gatekeeper to our internet experience buckle under the pressure of public organizing and activism.
Carr says consumers may have won this battle against predatory practices by cable internet providers, but Time Warner Cable isn't going away anytime soon.
They see their traditional market for cable television as under threat, and it's under threat directly from a free and open internet. Other internet providers, including Comcast and AT&T, you know, all of the largest high-speed internet providers in the country, are still considering new ways that they can profit more heavily from internet use.
For more information about the fight against Time Warner Cable, go to StopTheCaps.com.
The Women's Media Equity Collaborative is a new initiative that aims to create a network of communication across the more than 350 organizations that teach, produce, distribute, or advocate for women's media in print, on the radio, in video, and in blogs. Ariel Doherty is the co-founder of Women Make Movies and the national project director of the collaborative.
This field of women's media organizations and outlets has actually never had a forum of its own to meet and strategize and talk about what its problems are. And given 20-plus years of backlash in the mainstream community against women's issues, this community of women's media is severely underfunded, misunderstood for its nature and what its purpose is, And I really feel very strongly that there is no way in which women's issues and the women's movement can advance forward without a very strong media arm.
The first major undertaking of the collaborative was to create a searchable database of women's media organizations. Susan Feiner, a feminist economist and a professor at the University of Southern Maine, is a principal investigator of the project. Feiner has tasked her students in her Women, Knowledge, and Power class to find the organizations, collect more information, and organize the data. Feiner says that one of the major goals of the collaborative is to establish a model of sustainable funding. They'll discuss their findings, among many other issues, at a summit on July 16th at the Allied Media Conference in Detroit.
One of the goals of the summit is to discuss our funding needs collaboratively. Right now, many, many, many of these organizations are just every couple of months on the brink of a financial disaster. And they have to spend so much time and energy writing grants and doing fundraising that the fundraising crowds out the media work that they're trying to do.
For more information about the Women's Media Equity Collaborative, go to mediaequity.net. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, April 26, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful and historic Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Kevin Phillips. He'll be joining us in a few minutes. We're working on some technical difficulties with the lines, but we'll be with Mr. Phillips very soon. Before we go to Kevin Phillips, though, let me just say a couple of things. As many of you know, most of you, I hope. 1 week ago today was the Pledge Drive program here on WILL that we do twice a year to support this station, to support the program. And you, my beloved listeners, as usual, went way above and beyond the call of duty to support this program and to support WILL. And for that, I'm very much in your debt and very grateful. I don't have the exact figures, and I like to report on the exact number of people who did make pledges. So I will get that information hopefully for you by next week, at which point I will report back to you. These are difficult times for everyone, for the economy. In fact, with no sense of irony or no coincidence, we have Kevin Phillips on to talk about the full dimensions of the economic and political problems facing the United States today. So we know that it's difficult for people to give money to support public radio. They want to save their money, understandably. And so when you do give it, it's that much more appreciated because we need it now more than ever. And I'd like to think that you need programs like this and stations like WILL AM 580 now more than ever as well. So thank you again. And now I've been notified by our producer, Andrew Boyle, we're ready to go. So I'm privileged at this point to welcome to the phone lines of WILL, Kevin Phillips. Kevin Phillips has been a political and economic commentator for more than three decades, probably one of the most illustrious political writers of our times, who's written numerous best-selling books, including American Theocracy and American Dynasty. And his newest book, I think arguably as important as anything he's ever written, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism, published by Viking last year with a new paperback edition just out. Kevin Phillips, welcome to Media Matters.
Happy to be with you.
Again, sir, it's been a pleasure to read your book, although I must say it's not, as you probably well know and have heard from others, it's not the book with the happy ending or the magic button to push to solve all our problems.
Pleasure doesn't really describe it, I suspect.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that's striking me as I read this, and there were many things that were striking, but is how until quite recently, and I don't think we're still there quite yet, the problems you describe in this book of the increasing financialization of our economy and of our politics was almost entirely off the radar of our intellectual class and our news media and our punditocracy. They were just asleep at the switch for the last two decades, weren't they?
Well, I think that's right. It's hard for me to really imagine how so many people could have been so unaware of such a Well, large and historically significant problem, given that the last time this happened, you had manufacturing and railroads displacing agriculture, and it was a big issue for three decades.
And Kevin Phillips, what was also striking was, and it becomes more clear with the crash of 2008 and the recession we're in now, were that the parallels which you draw out between the attitude towards finance from the 1920s to the current era, with no sense of foreboding or irony. In one quote you had in particular from Reagan, President Reagan's Secretary of the Treasury, Donald Regan, was that he wanted to deregulate financial institutions, and I couldn't believe it when I read this, so we could, quote, return to the prosperity of the Coolidge era.
I know, quote. That's amazing. It's just part of a whole sequence that's kind of hard to fathom.
And in the book, you really pinpoint, I think many of our listeners, I want to sort of get the guts of the book before them. You pinpoint the shift of finance that took place in the U.S. economy to the Reagan era, to the 1980s. Why did it happen then, and what did that mean? What did that entail? What policies took place, and how did that affect our economy?
Well, I think when you take this back to the 1980s, that's the best decade. You could take it back a bit further, but one of the things that happened in 1980 when Reagan was coming in and Paul Volcker was faced, having been appointed to the Federal Reserve by President Carter, faced with a massive round of inflation, he had to let interest rates climb to about 20%. And that had the effect of just putting the economy through a terrific ringer. And a lot of damage was done by what needed to be done to correct the problems in the economy. So in no sense was it one of these magic, now you see it, now you don't bail out Houdini shows. We really paid a price, and a lot of people were hurt. After that, bailouts became the rule of thumb. And when finance got into a problem, finance would be bailed out, and the government did that over the next 25 years, I would say 12 to 14 times. You had a Federal Reserve Board that would always drop rates and rescue the financial sector when they got in trouble. And you had a sense on the part of government, I think, although nobody would admit it, they had decided that finance was the sector that government was going to favor.
And what was striking, too, is now that many of us since the events of the last year have taken a look at economic history a little more closely, you know, one of the great lessons that came out of the Depression was the need to keep a firm regulatory handle on the financial sector for fear that you would get into the situation we're in now. But at every turn over the last 25 years, our government has done pretty much everything to eliminate that lesson or to ignore that lesson.
There was a relentless willingness to deregulate. It began in the late 1970s. It went into overdrive in 1980 when they had to take the cap off interest that could be paid. Essentially, there was a belief that if you liberated finance, it would be able to do better. Now, the lesson of 1929 to 33 at that point was, you know, close to 50 years old. I think that's sort of a time frame you need to forget something like that. And so the principle was just let them do it. And every obstacle basically was taken away finally in 1999, and this under a Democrat, Bill Clinton. They signed off on repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had been the old New Deal legislation that kept commercial banking from merging with investment banking or merging with insurance or merging with real estate operations. By the time we came into the decade we're now about to leave, essentially you had everything in finance was allowed to team up with everything else for any kind of speculative purpose. And essentially, most of the opinion molders in both parties thought that it was a great thing just to give them their head, that this was the new wave in the economy.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Kevin Phillips, who you've just been listening to, author of many books, including the brand new book, or relatively brand new book, with a new paperback edition just out, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. And our telephone number here, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, is 333-9455, or our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. The book, one of the things that's most striking about it, Mr. Phillips, is that you've done a great deal of research and you bring to light and document the extent of financialization and what this means for the real economy or the overall economy in one place that I've never seen anywhere else. There may be other books that come later that do more of this, but I think you were the first book to really capture the process. And one thing that was very striking to me was a graph you had in the book that documented the relationship of the amount of debt in the economy to the size of the GDP, or the actual output of goods and services of the economy. Can you talk a little bit about how that changed and how dramatic it's been?
Well, these are two very important measurements. The first is debt, and I'm talking about tradable debt, so-called credit market debt, as a percentage of the U.S. GDP. And then very closely related to it, but in some ways even more scary, is the extent to which the size of debt overall, if you take the financial sector, its role in the GDP on a different type of basis and different calculation, whereas the financial sector, when everything tumbled in the late 1920s, was probably 5% of the GDP. By 1980, it was up to 10 to 12%, the finance, insurance, and real estate sector. Then by 2004, at the peak of the expansion of the whole mortgage and housing bubble, you had finance, insurance, and real estate all come together now, 20.6% of the GDP. In other words, they were the biggest thing in the private economy. Now, by this point, if you took all credit market debt in the United States, now this is the total of all tradable debt, you were up to a level where you had basically 330-340% of the gross domestic product. In other words, it was 3.5 times on an overall basis the size of the gross domestic product. I realize these numbers get tricky and cute, but you have these two measurements, basically, of Goliath. The first is a measurement of just finance and its role in the American economy, and the second is the measurement of the enormity of debt, which moved well ahead of the role that debt had played back in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and that was in a much smaller economy.
And not to put too fine a point on this, but, I mean, the importance of this, among other things, is that ultimately the people who hold all this credit, who hold all this paper, expect to have the right to translate their assets, if they're owed the money, into real goods and services. And so you have a lot more paper allocated to, you know, a smaller group of goods and services. So eventually something has to give.
Always something has to give, and the difficulty is that when finance basically fell apart in 1929, a lot had to give, but the dominant part of the economy was manufacturing, which was 30%, something like that. So we hadn't been, in essence, kicked in the vitals, but this time, when it happened, finance had become the dominant part of the economy. So the consequences of having Goliath fall off the beanstalk as opposed to a teenage Jack is just incredible. And that's why you hear about figures when they talk about the bailout of the Fed allocating another $1 trillion of individual banks or insurance companies getting packages of $150 billion or $185 billion. This is the staggering new math. This is what happens when a sector that people think of as collateral, as not the main part of the economy, has made itself into the main part of the economy, and then, boom, it falls.
Well, there you go again, Kevin Phillips, with more depressing. But, I mean, to get to that point, I mean, most people are trying to say, well, no, as bad as this gets, it can't be as bad as the 1930s because they have parents or grandparents or maybe in some cases great-grandparents who've told them how dark that decade was for Americans. But by the logic of your argument, if finances plays a much larger role today and it's collapsed, it seems to suggest we might even be in for, dare I say, a rockier ride than the 1930s?
Well, I think it'll be rockier, but I think it'll be different. One of the critical yardsticks here is that in 1929, when the United States went through the first ringer, essentially it was a country that had come out of World War One as the leading creditor nation in the world. People had borrowed from us. We were a manufacturing, not a financial power, as I said. We had the dollar was a strong currency. We were starting to ascend in the world, but we hadn't gotten to the point where the dollar was the international currency as we have now. At that point in time, we were the leading producer in the world of oil, so we dominated the energy markets. We were on top of just about everything, and within a year after FDR's inauguration, and I don't think it was his, I'm sorry, within a decade after his inauguration, and I don't think it was specifically his doing, but he helped, you have the United States essentially the most powerful country in the world, again, on the cusp of its greatest dominance. Now, nobody in their right mind thinks that at this point we're on the cusp of a greater dominance globally than we've just had. On the contrary, the United States is the world's leading debtor. It's no longer the leading manufacturer. It's no longer the leading oil producer. Its currency is the global reserve currency, so the Chinese are sitting on $2 trillion worth of it and others on substantial amounts. We're at their mercy in a lot of ways. Now, people in Washington try to say, oh, well, since they have so many dollars, they can't afford to do anything that would hurt the dollars. There's a lot of good replies to that, which I won't try to do right in this time period. But it's mind-boggling the vulnerabilities that we have, and I think the global ramifications this time are far more important and far more negative than they were in the early 30s.
Well, Kevin Phillips, let's talk about that, because that is the subtitle of the book, The Global Crisis of American Capitalism. And throughout the book, and it's been a theme of yours more in your recent writings, but especially in this book, is the notion that the United States is at a historic turning point, and it's a turning point that is not in a very it's going into a phase of its history that's not going to be considered the glory days. And its role as a world power is changing, and from U.S. perspective, changing to a smaller role. What is the difference globally about the economic situation we're now from 1930 or 1931?
Well, I think what we're looking at here is that because we've thrown so much, I don't want to blame the fiscal stimulus, some of which was necessary, even if it wasn't perfectly arranged. But the stimulus, the games coming out of the bailout on the part of the Federal Reserve, you're putting the country in line for major inflation. Bernanke even admits that, but he says, Bernanke will be able, like Hercules, to bring it all back. No way he will. So in essence, you've got inflation coming online in this country in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. I don't pretend to be able to calibrate it. And at that point in time, all the dollars that are held around the world will become hostage to our keeping that inflation under control. If we can't, then the dollar is going to dive. If the dollar dives, then we have two things we have to do. We have to raise interest rates in order to support the dollar, which would then send the economy down further. Or you accept inflation, which would send the dollar down further, and then just refocus the question. So being the leading global power and having our currency as the world's reserve currency, we're put in the position that the British were put in after World Wars I and II. If you can't sustain that any longer, if all of a sudden you're the borrower and you've lost your old circumstances, your currency is going to dive. As your currency dives, your ability to make, well, for example, your financial industry, the center of the world, it's not going to be at that point. The British lost that in World War II, and we're going to lose it as soon as the chickens come home to roost on all the inflation about to gestate.
Is there a window that the Obama administration and the U.S. government has, and the global financial community for that matter, has while the dollar is still in decent shape and still accepted as the global currency to enact policies to avoid the worst possible outcome?
Well, they, of course, insist that that can't happen. Now, I don't think that they're too credible on that. When I say they, the Federal Reserve. Now, exactly what the president thinks and doesn't think, I don't know. He just said he was 100% behind Bernanke, but I think that was on the question, really, of Bernanke and Paulson's alleged misbehavior in dealing with Merrill Lynch and the Bank of America some months back. He didn't indicate that he was behind every percent of Bernanke's monetary policy. I don't know what else they can do. I think if Obama had wanted to take a new tack, he would have had to have it in mind and to be moving in that direction from within days after the election. Instead, he basically kept on the personnel of the bailout, you know, proving of Bernanke, taking Geithner, who had been the New York Fed Bank president, and making him Secretary of the Treasury and keeping all these Paulson people on in the Treasury Department, too. He basically bought in to the dynamics and the analysis of the Bush bailout. And maybe they could have changed that if they had given a fair amount of notice, made it something of an issue in the election, and were prepared to accept the implosion of some of the misbehaving element of the financial sector. They decided not to. That's the easier decision to make, to go down the pathway that seems to be the one you have to take, because this is, or was at least, we're probably still is, but was the biggest sector of the private economy. So I think he's lost his options. Now, if this doesn't work well in the next 6 months, maybe he gets one more chance to roll the dice. But it's hard for me to see how, because at that point he'd have to be saying, look, what I did, I should have done something else, and I shouldn't have signed off on more of the same, and we've got a much bigger challenge than that. It's hard for me to see him doing that.
Our guest, Kevin Phillips, author of the new book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism, published by Viking. If you'd like to call into WILL with a question or comment for Kevin Phillips, the telephone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Kevin Phillips, one of the issues you've written about, in fact, it was two decades ago that you wrote a book on this subject, a very eye-opening book for many Americans, comes back in this book on global finance, which is the growth of economic inequality in the United States. And again, this is one of the great lessons of the 1930s, that if you have growing inequality in an advanced capitalist economy, it will tend to produce instability, if not crisis. And that was one of the most justifications for having trade unions and a social wage and keeping the standard of living relatively high. And your book documents, again, how over the past two or three decades, the rise of financialization has been accompanied by a spectacular increase in economic inequality. Is economic inequality something that has to be addressed if we're ever really going to get around these economic problems, or is that just something that's a moral issue?
It's a hard one to answer, because I think it has to be addressed in the sense that I don't believe you can have a successful tax policy in this country, because we're going to have to raise more money, and that's going to mean more taxes, unless it creates more of a resonance for fairness and for making the people who've made so much money out of the fact that they've been favored by the tax code and by the government, making them pay more. So I would say you have to be aware of this massive inequality and things like the AIG bonuses and have that front and center. On the other hand, if you make that the number one focus, you're probably going to miss the need to make some major overhauls in the way that finance is regulated, what it's allowed to do the role that you expect it to play. I don't think you can jump in there and say we're just going to redo the whole thing completely without stating a better case against finance and the abuse of power that they really employed in the later part of this quarter century of financialization and bubble blowing. There's no excuse for allowing the methodologies of financialization and the extent to which the mere emphasis on finance as opposed to other things almost automatically favors a smaller group of people by far than manufacturing did. I think all of this has to be dealt with. I don't think the administration is laying the groundwork.
Kevin Phillips, another issue that occurred to me as I read the book, Bad Money, and it's occurred to me as I've talked to others on this, especially economists, is that over the past two or three decades, as finance and debt have played a much larger role in our economy and have really become a dominant element, the question that seems unclear to me is, could our economy, without this growth of these bubbles, so to speak, the housing and internet bubbles and stock market bubbles, what sort of economy would we have had we not gone that direction if we'd done nothing else? Because the argument, I guess a way to put it differently, is the argument on behalf of speculation and bubbles is that without them, we'd have stagnation and the system wouldn't really be working very well. This is what gives life to it, although at a high price. I mean, is there an alternative to financialization?
I think there were alternatives, but in order to have exercised the alternatives, we have to go back to the early 80s. And I remember at that time, and I actually wrote a book that touched on the issue, there was the question, did we need to have an industrial policy or strategy? And Bob Reich and others were writing about this. And the notion that they had was that the United States would lose its manufacturing base, partly because of the competition of unfair competition from countries where the government was basically hand in glove with business and was supporting certain types of manufacturing, especially the high value added variety. We didn't go down that path, partly because the response of conservatives in particular, but plenty of liberal economists too, was you can't have the government picking winners and losers. And that turns out to have been a total and complete fraud because presidents of both parties bailed out finance relentlessly. Fed chairmen of both parties basically used interest rates to push them way down and allow finance to recover from bad decisions at the same time as they took money away from senior citizens trying to make it on interest in bank CDs and things like that. So we made a decision 20 to 25 years ago to go with the financial sector, which if that could be recalled, if we could somehow go back and have a decision made that you were not going to put all the chips on finance, you were not going to bail these people out. If they made a stupid decision, they had to live with it. And it was far more important to try to keep industry afloat and competitive in all these new ways, especially with Asia, but also with countries like Germany and then Switzerland, which are terrific on manufacturing, even though they're also very shrewd and advanced financially. We didn't do it, and we're paying the price.
Our guest, Kevin Phillips, author of Bad Money, and Kevin Phillips, I mean, one of the aspects of your book is really the difficulty our political system is having to successfully address the problem that you outline. And I think for a lot of people, the traditional nomenclatures, the Republicans are the party of Wall Street and financial interests and big business and wealthy people, and the Democrats represent everyone else, or at least not those people. And so the expectation would be that a Democratic administration, Clinton perhaps, and certainly Obama, would be much more likely to get aggressive and get tough with the Wall Street finance crowd on behalf of everyone else. But as I read your book, you certainly convinced me that was not the case. Explain the role of finance in our political system now, if you would, please.
Well, for one thing, it's the biggest source of money spent to lobby. And as befits its enormous power and wealth, it's the biggest source of campaign contributions. But there's also been a realignment of the two parties in which the Republicans have gone more and more to a pattern that's based on the South and the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains and so forth, and the Democrats to a pattern which is based on the Northeast, the Great Lakes, and the Pacific. Now, if you go back and you look at the politics that FDR represented in 1933 after he'd won, he was elected by what is really now more the Republican coalition. And Hoover didn't carry many states, but he got his best percentages in the Northeast, the Great Lakes, and the Pacific. The Democrats now represent, in their presidential coalition, the bulk of the affluent metropolitan states and areas that in which the financial and money management businesses are concentrated. And they certainly got more in the 2008 elections than the Republicans did. So I think what you've got right now is a two-party system in which, partly because it's Christmas past and Christmas present, you've got two parties that have gotten a lot of money out of this sector. One has to talk more negatively than the other, and the Democrats talk more negatively. But in terms of actual constituencies, I think the Democrats have at least as much at stake.
And that leads to the question then, you know, we have a sort of a two-party system in the United States. The electoral laws are written in such a way as to make it virtually impossible, though not impossible, but certainly virtually impossible at the national level to create a third party that could challenge. And the Republican Party right now, it seems that based on the where the Democrats are at, the logical position it would could assume would be to take the anti-finance position, and that there would be many welcome voters, and, but that would go pretty much against the grain of what they've been up to for a long time. Where does, I mean, you've written about the Republican Party specifically at some length in your career. Where does the Republican Party specifically go in the future? What is its near and long-term trajectory in your view?
I don't think they have much of a thought process, but I don't think the Democrats have too much of a one either. The difficulty at this point is that one of the few things the Republicans can do here with some plausibility is basically to be negative and say that this bailout is mistaken, it's not going to work, and the Democrats are therefore in line to screw up the economy. A lot of the Republicans privately admit, and many publicly because they voted against the bailout back in the autumn before the election, that the Bush administration messed it all up too. So I think you're going to see the Republicans oppose the bailouts. Now, whether or not they have any larger financial or economic viewpoint, I don't think they really have much of a one, not that could at least be expected to succeed. But that may not matter too much because the Democrats are in the position of being in there and seeming to embrace the whole bailout approach that we thought had lost in the election. So I'm not certain that the Republicans are as doomed by their sort of negativism and not having much to say. Because the Democrats have taken a position which a lot of their own people don't think is too good on the bailout, and they look like they've wedded themselves to this. So I'm very disappointed in the two-party system. It's been a long time since I had good things to say about it.
Our guest is Kevin Phillips. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Kevin Phillips is the author of the book Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. Our phone lines are open at WILL, the number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Kevin Phillips.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wanted to know what you were thinking about the all these instruments that were made. The one that comes to mind best is the credit default swap, and maybe we, you know, of other ones. But I think I heard a story that they're talking about restricting them so it isn't just really a casino economy, that you would be able to buy these kind of insurance instruments if you had some holding standing to buy it. In other words, it wasn't just a side bet. Something on that, implications of that. And then I wonder whether you would say something about what I think I heard Mr. Nader say a while back, speaking of outside insight into the system, that the credit unions are actually doing pretty well. And I wonder whether you would speculate on the idea of making these banks mark to market, which they successfully have gotten away from, making them mark to market and sort of in some way advantaging the credit union system of availing itself some of these slightly detoxified assets, or if they want them, so that there would be sort of a willing buyer as long as it was priced in a way that was reasonable. So could I ask you to treat those two points, if that's clear enough?
Yeah, let me try.
Thank you very much, caller.
Take the sequence here. First, in terms of these assorted derivatives and securitized products, one of the biggest abuses of the last 20 years has been a way that these became so central to the profit dynamics of the major banks and investment firms that they made 30, 40, 50% of their profits from them. And it's impossible to list them, but, well, for example, credit default swaps. Now, basically, that's a crypto insurance policy for people that want to bet or hedge their own involvement, who want to bet on the direction that the credit of an institution is going to take. Is it going to go up or down? Are they in danger or not? The nominal amount of credit default swaps by 2007, early 2008, before everything hit the fan, was, I believe, about $55, $60 trillion. Now, in point of fact, that's just nominal. If everything went wrong, you might have had a real-world vulnerability of $4, $5, $6 trillion, something like that, perhaps. But this stuff was part of an innovation wave that makes Frankenstein's change in the laboratory look like peanuts by comparison. They came up with, in nominal terms, about $500 trillion worth of derivatives. And again, the whole thing is not at stake, but people estimated that if everything fell apart, it could be $15, $20 trillion. Now, the securitization, this is the big reason why they wanted all these lousy mortgages, because they weren't so much concerned with individual mortgages as slapping them all together in these, in essence, portfolios of 400 or 800 or 1,200, and then selling them as securitized products. And they'd get great ratings from Fitch and S&P and Moody's, and then it'd turn out that far from being AAA or AA, they were lucky if they were BBB, and they fell apart. So that's a disaster, and the way in which these things were just applauded by the Greenspans and Bernankes and Treasury secretaries and Clinton people and Bush people is really a sorry commentary. Now, in terms of what can be done with the various forms of banking institutions, I think there's some support, whether it's enough to get a serious debate, but there is some support for the notion of trying to turn commercial banks into something more of a public utility than they are. And that would have the implication of pushing them more in the direction of a credit union, because you're trying to be able to restrain them from doing all the speculative and gamesmanship type of things that produce this problem. If you go back in the 1890s, railroads had been very much involved in massively watered stock and debt that just fell apart and helped cause the crash of 1893. But within two decades, they were public utilities because people weren't going to let that stuff go on any longer. I think we have to take some of the same views of commercial banks and of Fannie and Freddie in the mortgage arena. And I know there's a little more talk in this direction than appears in public so far.
Our guest, Kevin Phillips. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. So following up on this issue, Kevin Phillips, some of the economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, Nobel-winning economists, have been quite critical of the bailout plan of the Obama administration and have said basically this is a classic case where you need to, you know, really nationalize these failing banks, take it over, clean out the system and put it back on its feet, and then reprivatize it and restructure it. But anything short of that is basically just trying to do favors for the shareholders in these banks, and that's really a really bad policy decision at this point. What is your sense of that argument those guys are making?
I basically agree with it. I think if they had, they being the government, had taken a hard line and had been on top of the potential dynamics of the problem, what they should have done back in the early part of 2008 when Bear Stearns went under and they had to arrange for a bailout, was to have evolved a policy that would figure out exactly how much bad paper they were going to have to deal with and the extent to which ultimately a very substantial percentage of the major institutions would be affected and figure out the most economical way of repackaging them. But their basic approach, Paulson and Bernanke, and I think it's still true under this administration, is not to force any harm on them at all, but to basically bail them out. But the problem is you're looking at cancer patients who have to have a financial surgery, and then what you're giving them are Band-Aids and transfusions. Transfusions endlessly, but nothing to change the corpus.
Kevin Phillips, I'd like to go back to your comments earlier about impending inflation, perhaps even hyperinflation, in the next 6 months, 9 months, year, 2 years possibly, because a lot of economists now are talking about the opposite, interestingly enough, which is the threat of deflation. What took place during the Great Depression when you have tremendous amount of stagnation and a loss of buying power, prices coming down, and been sounding the alarms about, you know, the black hole effect that has on economic development and incomes and standard of living. Can that circle be squared, or are these just two contradictory approaches to our future?
Well, I think the concern about deflation is largely with respect to assets. I know they try to pretend that there's a real possibility of long-term deflation in prices, but I don't believe that's the case. And one of the most important differences between the current crisis and the 1929 to 33 crisis, when Ben Bernanke wrote his doctoral thesis on the 29 to 33 crisis, and so he claims to have this great expertise for dealing with the present one based on those circumstances. But from 1925 or 27 through 1929, back then, they were having deflation in commodity prices around the world, so that when the Depression hit, you already had a deflationary aspect gathering. Now, what you have this time is that up until the summer of 2008, you were looking at commodity inflation. And I think that what's going on now is more like problems we had from the middle 60s to the early 80s. There's ongoing inflation, but when the economy takes a big hit and is crashing, for a period of time, the prices will go down, but they won't go down in the longer term, because after you had major stock market declines and recessions, first in 69 and 70, and then in 73, 74, You had big declines in financial assets, but then as soon as the economy started to recover, the commodity prices and inflation went up again. So I think that what we're looking at is that with all the liquidity and money supply Bernanke's putting in motion, he's going to be feeding a very different type of situation than existed in 29 to 33, when there is a global inflationary predisposition, and therefore to be putting all this increased money supply and liquidity out there could be extremely reckless. And I think he understands the problem, but I think he has this totally, totally blue sky view of the ability of somebody in the Federal Reserve who is responsible to an administration in Congress, the ability of that person to call it back, to take the stimulus out of the economy. I think that's a pipe dream. And I don't think he ever would have indulged this the same way if he'd understood, which he did not in 2007 and 2008, that we were having major commodity inflation.
And just to follow up on your earlier point, because I think it is burying the lead in this interview if I don't get this back out. I mean, but you anticipate, Kevin Phillips, in the next 6 months, year, 2 years, at some point in the fairly near future, is that the policy options facing the U.S. government are going to be basically pick your poison, dreadful ones, because whatever is done to arrest inflation enhances stagnation, or vice versa, or simultaneously. And so there's really not much that can be done.
Well, I'm afraid that that's what's going to happen. And the concern that I share with whether it's Stiglitz or Bob Reich or Paul Krugman, is it because they won't do the hard surgery on the toxic financial institutions. They just keep pouring more money into trying to buy them back into happiness when there are much more fundamental flaws. So the banks sit there accumulating this money without doing very much with it and without necessarily saving themselves either, because you've got huge amounts of credit card debt likely to be pulling them down in commercial real estate, so that they may not be back in any successful mode before the end of 2010, in which case he isn't going to be able to take back the inflation and the money supply and liquidity, because you'll still have troubled banks, which would mean that in that case, because you haven't done the necessary surgery, you have to leave the monetary stimulus out there, which would be producing inflation in one dimension, even as you're still having assets deflation in the stock market and on the part of the financial community.
The book ends with a discussion of sort of the U.S. role in the world and what you call the great transferal to Asia as the coming dominant powers of the 21st century, as the United States sort of hands the baton, so to speak, or has it taken from it one way or the other. And I guess that's actually an important transition. One of the things that was striking at the very ending of the book, you said that one of the things we'll have to do is abandon the military hubris that the United States has. And it's a subject that doesn't come up in the book at all, but it does touch on really the other great issue about American political economy, which is sort of the dominant military role of the U.S. in the world. And how important is that as an economic issue, addressing the sort of massive number of bases and the wars we're fighting and the amount of spending we have on militarism?
Well, it's an absolutely central issue, because one of the backdrops to my whole concern about financialization, which actually got me started researching 25 years ago, was the extent to which the previous leading world economic powers, Britain, Holland, and Spain, when all the gold and silver was flowing in, let themselves pull the plug on their global economic supremacy by dint of getting so far extended in terms of global power and military commitment and alliances and general sort of imperial hubris, that they couldn't pull back. So they stayed in these places where they would get bogged down, and there really wasn't any reason for thinking they wouldn't be bogged down, but they had their prestige and their commitments and their pride. And what happened to each of the three countries? They built up massive amounts of debt, had to sell off their assets, and one way or another, with currency problems and financial panics, they had to retreat. They had to retreat from that global overreach. And this is big-time global overreach, and it's in a part of the world, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, where the British could tell us very well that you don't win long-term there. The Russians found out the hard way. Lots of people before that, you know, from Alexander the Great down to previous ones from different dynasties and empires. That is not a part of the world that you make your bones in. And the notion that Obama feels called upon to carry this baton in a way that seems similar, and now we've got Hillary Clinton saying all these things about what we've got to do there, it's sort of reminiscent of how the Clintons kept the whole Iraqi ball in the air, too. I'm not pleased by this in the sense that I think the analogy to the overextension of the previous empires and the amount of money they spent and the foolishness of making these commitments in an open-ended way without a sense of vulnerability is just central to their problems.
Well, speaking of great empires, it was 5 years ago that the Abu Ghraib photos first came out of the U.S. Torture of prisoners in Iraq. And I recall Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes said something that was quite extraordinary. He said, you know, he was talking about the photos, and he said, you know, I don't know what was going on in the last days of the Roman Empire, but I suspect it was something just like this. And it was making the connection between torture and the decline of the vibrancy of a dominant power. And the torch issues returned to the headlines, albeit briefly, over the last week with the release of the torture memos. And it's unclear what's going to happen. But there's tremendous pressure to in Washington on both sides of the aisle to bury this issue completely. How important is an issue like this for sort of saying to the world and to ourselves what sort of nation we are?
Oh, I don't know, because even if they apologize for some of it, first of all, most of the countries do things like that, too, especially during their more troubled seasons and in the spotlight. And I don't think that's going to convince anybody that we still don't have the sort of prideful commitment and overreaching commitment that's so visible in the Middle East right now. But what countries do in the later stages of their trajectories is pretty notable for this sort of thing. And you mentioned the Roman Empire. The way the British approached Iraq in the 1920s, they couldn't afford to be there, so they couldn't afford to station troops. They had the mandate. They were in charge. So what they did is the Royal Air Force was happy to be able to keep some planes up in the air. And essentially the way that they did, well, when Winston Churchill was colonial secretary at the time in the early 20s, they just tried to enforce the British rule in Iraq by bombing villages. It was a pretty striking example of early use of air power in a way that really didn't achieve all that much, but it was cheap.
We have time for one final caller with Kevin Phillips. We don't have much time, but just a little. Let's go now to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Kevin Phillips.
Thank you. I'm wondering if, Mr. Phillips, and you are aware of a book by David Corton, is that his name, Agenda for a New Economy? Last night on alternative radio, WILL, David Barsamian's guest was this gentleman who says that he's done quite a lot of work on going around the world and finding out what values people really have, and he finds that we're all pretty much on the same line, that we all want clean air and good water and food for our children and so forth. And that if we don't go after that instead of after money, if we don't turn the whole thing around where we don't equate money and wealth, but we equate happy lifestyle and less war and less poverty with wealth.
Well, I think that the likelihood that the United States would segue out of the recent circumstances by pursuing what could be called either an ecotopian or a utopian or a massive reform agenda of an untried variety historically is about nil. Generally speaking, what happens is that the country flounders. But the British, for example, after the two world wars, when they'd lost their economic supremacy, they turned on the upper brackets in the UK and they implemented a pretty far-reaching welfare state in which a lot of new money went for education and pensions and health and so forth. And by a lot of yardsticks, that was a pretty massive reform program. That, to me, is something that could happen in the United States if people just got determined that they wouldn't allow any cutbacks in Social Security and Medicare, and if you have to tax all the people on Wall Street to do it, that's what you'll do. But I think there's very little likelihood of turning to a more utopian approach, which is how I would describe the Corton package.
Kevin Phillips, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Our guest, Kevin Phillips, the author of Bad Money, available through Viking Books, just out in paper. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board. Andrew Boyle, my tremendous producer, for arranging today's show. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back in 167 hours at Barbara Ehrenreich. Have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll have intervals of clouds and sunshine today with a high of 82 degrees. Tonight, cloudy skies with a low of 63. Tomorrow, there's a chance of rain and isolated thunderstorms with a high of 77. Monday night, showers continue with a low of 56. Tuesday, showers clearing by the afternoon with a high of 64. This is WILL, AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.